Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 27th of June, 2002, in the location of Koinonia Fireside. And our presenter's name is Annette Andrews Lux. And today's session is LUA 2002-04. And it's titled, If You Hoard Your Mana, A Daily Bread Spirituality. Let's listen in.
Well, welcome. We can begin the tape now. My name's Annette Andrews Lux, and it's good to see you here. And today, we're going to take another look at a text that I'm sure is familiar to everybody. But sometimes those familiar texts, it's good to take some time out like this to look again with fresh eyes and see some pieces perhaps that you didn't see before or see them in a new perspective. So I'm hoping that our journey through this text today will at least give a few choice morsels for you to take home to sustain you in as we explore this theme this summer of mana. I call this session, If You Hoard Your Mana, because I love that phrase. And I always thought I'd write a book called If You Hoard Your Mana. It would be, you know, all different aspects of the call to trust in Scripture. And I still might do it someday. But I see this passage as so powerful to as a model for us of what I call a daily bread spirituality. Aspects of how we are to live with the invitation that God offers to us to live in trust. And so we're going to look at that passage that in Exodus 16, the first 20 verses, and kind of go through it piece by piece. And I want you to listen also for the call that you hear in terms of translating it into language that we can take home for our own spiritual journeys. One of the things about Scripture that I think is so wonderful is Exodus 16. We're going to look at the first 20 verses. And what I was saying was one of the things about Scripture that is so rich to me is that all of it, even passages that just seem totally bizarre, that don't have anything to do with us, if we step back and pause and look at it, there's always something that can call to us. And or even if it's maybe something we don't like or we don't agree with, it might be just a piece for us to look at, to listen to a dissident voice, so to speak, for us to listen to. But this Exodus journey in particular, I taught in a program that used the book of Exodus for about 10 years, and so I went through the whole book a number of times, and it's got so many pieces that can be a mirror for us. It's like God bless the Israelites. They messed up so many times, we can relate to them. You know? And so there's a very human picture, and with the ups and the downs and the different aspects of the spiritual journey that we're going to look at in a minute in terms of use this story as a paradigm for the phases in our journeys. So we'll look at that chart on the board in just a couple minutes. I want to begin by listening to the text, and I'm wondering, is there somebody who likes to proclaim Scripture that might like to read it for us? Would you like to? Why don't you stand to read, just so we be sure and catch you all on tape.
The whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elim, and Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way, I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on other days. So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, in the evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your complaining against the Lord. For what are we that you complain against us? And Moses said, when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and your fill of bread in the morning, because the Lord has heard the complaining that you utter against him, what are we? Your complaining is not against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole congregation of the Israelites, draw near to the Lord, for he has heard your complaining. And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the Israelites, they looked toward the wilderness, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, I have heard the complaining of the Israelites. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall have your fill of bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening, quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a fine, flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, it is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather as much of it as each of you needs, an omer to a person according to the number of persons, all providing for those in their own tents. The Israelites did so, some gathering more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, those who gathered much had nothing over, and those who gathered little had no shortage. They gathered as much as each of them needed. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over until morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them.
Thank you. I like the story because it's, as I said, it shows struggle. And it also is a story about being in a time of transition. It's a very unsettled place that the Israelites are in when this event happens. And I think that's important because so often we're in times of transition where it is, our faith really is tested, and it's challenged, and it's upset, and it's torn apart, and sometimes it even seems like it may dwindle down to nothing. And I like the images that are presented to us in this story because I think they, in between the struggles that we hear in here, we have these little pieces that we can hold on to as promises, not only to the Israelites, but promises to us. This image of the whole congregation having set out and journeying in the desert, I think it's important to remember where they have left from. And because they are complaining that Moses has taken them away, and well, why did you ever bring us out here? It's almost like they've forgotten the cries that they put out to God just not too long ago in Egypt. When, what were the cries then? Back in Egypt. Pardon me?
Free us.
Yes, they were crying for freedom. They were crying for deliverance. They were crying out of pain and frustration and despair. It says they cried out to God and God heard their cry. And something happened. Moses was sent, deliverance happened. And now it's almost like they've forgotten that. And what I put up here is a paradigm chart. You know, a paradigm is an overarching image that we can lay on something that helps us see something else. And they have left Egypt. And as we said, Egypt is both literally but also symbolically, a place that doesn't work for us anymore. When they first went down to Egypt, remember when Joseph first went down there, things went pretty well. And they grew prosperous, and they multiplied, and they filled the land. But then something happened. A new Pharaoh came into power that knew not Joseph, it says. And things started to go downhill from then. And he started to use them for forced labor. And that this place that had been a refuge during the famine, time of famine in their own land, now became a place of oppression. And that kind of turn and switch in a circumstance, I think, happens many times in our life where something has worked for us and it doesn't anymore. It can be a relationship, it can be a job, it can be a commitment we've made, it can be a health issue, something we're struggling with our own health or with somebody else's health. But this Egypt is that symbol for all those places of not feeling at home anymore, not being satisfied, not being in a place that is life-giving. And the struggle, just as the Israelites did when they were in that kind of a place, they cried out to God for change to happen. Now, as I'm sure some of you know, change isn't always ushered in through means of our choice. Sometimes outside events happen that thrust us into a new situation. Sometimes we're fortunate to be able to seek out the change and initiate it happening. But even when that happens, even when we initiate it, such as for perhaps initiating the ending of a relationship or initiating leaving a job, there's often a this time, which is symbolized for us in the story, is the time in the desert, that what we're going to or the new thing has not formed yet. And so what I like about this is when we leave a place behind, a literal place or a symbolic place, an emotional place, a relationship place, something happens to cut us off from that. And in the Egyptians, in the Israelites' case, it was an act of deliverance. That act can be any kind of critical event that switches something for us. Sometimes it might be a very definitive moment. Other times it may be this kind of growing sense that I just can't keep like I've been doing anymore. Something's got to change. It might be a more subtle call to freedom that it grows in us. And then at one point, it bursts out and we must act. But what often happens in between this leaving of Egypt and this arrival at the promised land, which will be the place of newness, new possibility, new life, that is at the other end, there's this whole center place of the journey in the desert, the wilderness place, to pick up on our theme. Wilderness places can be externally defined, such as when we're uprooted and we're literally in a new place, and we haven't made those connections yet, we haven't made the relationships, maybe we haven't even found the job, we don't know where we're going to live. But it can also be a place inside us. If you've had times where you've moved into a place of just weariness and maybe even despair, a sadness, uncertainty, like, what am I doing with my life anyway? You know, the kind of classic midlife crisis, perhaps, or the loss of someone in your family or a dear one that throws you into a wilderness place, because the wilderness is defined by something that is not familiar. It's not home. It's not what you know. Everything's not in place. wilderness is something outside of the ordinary or outside of the what is my norm, what is my comfort zone. It's another way I've heard it talked about is like being out on the margins. You know, you've kind of been thrust out to the margins and you're not sure where things are going. So this center period, it also can be in a time of chaos is another way of talking about it. And chaos, as I said, can all be right in here. Does someone have a comment they wanted to make? I thought I saw a hand. Okay. Have some of you read Bill Bridges' book about transitions? Has anybody read that book? It's a really great book, but it's a whole book about the process of transition, and his language talks about the endings over here, the beginnings, and the promised land place, and in the middle, he calls it the neutral zone. And I like the way he describes it, but it's a little too nice of a term, I think, because it can really be a hard time. People retiring, you know, and that time right afterwards where, well, what's my life going to look like now? Empty nest times, you know. I was a mother, my life was whole, you know, defined by their schedule, and now what's it going to be? So all these, the times of doubts, fears, struggles, sometimes anger, sometimes deep, deep sadness, as we redefine and often have to wait for our lives to be redefined. Sometimes we have the control to act, and other times, depending on the kind of ending that we're experiencing, we don't have that much control, and we just have to move through that grief process or wait and see what's going to come. There's so many ways that we experience that. Maybe we think, you know, we're working on some degree in school or something, and we flunk a major test. You know, like I remember someone who was trying to get
the bar.
Yeah, pass the bar. He flunked it like 3 or 4 times. And he was like, he thrust him into this kind of place. Like, well, maybe I'm not supposed to be a lawyer. I mean, it like threw everything about the plans for his life into question because he didn't seem to be able to pass that test. And so there's so many ways that we're thrust into this desert or wilderness kind of experience. And we can relate to the kinds of questions and struggles that the Israelites find themselves in. Because what do they say to Moses as they come out there, they start complaining? In other places it says murmuring, you know, I love that word, they murmured against Moses. What are they complaining about?
They don't have enough to eat.
Yes. Did you bring us here to starve to death? But look at how they're talking about Egypt now. In Egypt, we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. It's like all of a sudden Egypt is starting to look pretty good. And I think that's a fascinating little turn if you read the opening chapters of Exodus, where it's all described as basically as hell. You know, they're working from night to day. They're totally controlled.
Their firstborn, their baby boys are being killed.
Yes, and now it's like everything's changed because now they're in the middle of the wilderness. They really don't know what their future's going to be now. And Egypt's starting to look pretty good because at least they had food. And I know that in the process of moving from a place of bondage to a place of freedom, there's often these little step backs that happen. Well, I know I said I wanted that, but now I'm not so sure because now I'm realizing how hard it's going to really be. Or how much it's gonna cost me to really move to that new place. So Egypt is starting to look pretty good to them, and they're complaining in a new way, crying out to God in a new way. Would that we had died in Egypt, because what is the underlying, here they had this amazing experience of deliverance, and now they're out in the desert, and they don't seem to have anything to eat or drink. What is that going to call into question in terms of their relationship with God? What?
His wisdom in sending them out there. I mean, they get out there and they're like, is this really what you had in mind?
Yes. And is God going to stay with us through this journey? I mean, in those dark times, is God here with us or not?
Doesn't do any good to have a cloud unless we've got some food.
Yes. Like, yeah, the pillar of clouds there, but the nitty-gritties of necessity of life, how is that going to happen? So there's a questioning of whether God's really present. And that's another piece of this, is in those the wilderness times, the despair times, the dark times, the uncertain times, we often question whether God continues to be present with us.
It's interesting that they complain to Moses, and Moses says, wait a minute, complaint's not with me, it's to God.
Yeah, he's saying, well, you know, I'm just your leader here, folks. I'm not the top man in charge. Yeah, that's kind of an interesting piece in there, where he says, you know, what you're really doing is questioning God. You're complaining to me, but what you're really doing is questioning whether God is here with us. And you know, I just had this image flash in my mind of even when Jesus was out in the desert, there was what did the devil try to tempt him with? Into doubting that God was really with him and that God would provide. It's almost like it's this human, you know, underbelly that we can always get something in there, because our sense of trust often is very surfacey. And you know, I'm totally speaking about myself in this too. It's like that. It seems like that's one of the invitations into a real deepening and maturing spirituality, is how much we can take the trust from up here, like, oh yeah, I know God's going to take care of me, I know God will provide, saying the words, to having it be in our hearts and in our guts. Do we really believe that? Do we really trust that?
Yeah, it's interesting to remember that just the paragraph before, they've been complaining because they didn't have water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the Lord said to Moses, you know, do the water deal, and he did. And it, so to see this as a sequence.
Yes.
Oh, now what are they complaining about?
First it was thirst, yeah. Then it was hunger. Yes. And it's, you know, it seems like in many ways, in the story of Exodus, there is repeated lack of trust, and God always comes back. And sometimes there's an anger thing that happens, but the bottom line is always
God was with them.
Yes, that God's with them and God will provide. But it's, you kind of almost get a sense sometimes, like, aren't these guys ever going to learn, you know? But that's what is so human about it. It's like people say, oh, well, they just had this deliverance at the Red Sea. They shouldn't have any questions. But
What I'm seeing is that their going is getting rough and they're getting scared.
Yes.
That happened then, but what's going to happen now? We're hungry now.
Yes.
And our livestock and our children.
And that's why this sense of what God is teaching them, as we'll see through this, the gifts of bread, of manna that God gives, is it's almost like trust is always a choice for today. It's like, yes, maybe I was fine 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, 2 years ago, but today, what am I facing and how am I going to respond today? So as they're going through this crisis of trust again, and they're complaining to Moses, the message that Moses gives to the people, this, I think you read the RSV too, I think, didn't you? That says, draw near to the Lord, for he has heard your complaining. Another, the this must have been the New American in my notes, says, present yourself to the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. But they're called to draw close, to come and to be present to God, because God has heard. It's almost like an echo of what we find in the first part of Exodus, when it says the Israelites cried out, and God tells Moses to tell them, God has heard your cries. Here they are crying out again, and Moses is to tell them, God has heard your cries. It's like, you know, the repetition is because it's to get it in our brains and in our hearts that God does hear, because we often distrust. So they promise. The promise is that in the twilight you shall eat meat. This is verse 12. I've heard the complaining of the Israelites. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall have your fill of bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. And you know that phrase, you shall know that I am the Lord your God. You shall know that I am Yahweh, the one who is with you. We hear that time and time again, but it's one way of looking. I mean, it's not just, I think, a cognitive, you know, you'll understand I'm God and the other pagan gods aren't or something, but then you shall know that I am Yahweh. I am the one with you, and you shall know it, you know, in your hearts, in your bodies, in your soul. Know that I'm God. Pardon me?
In your full stomach.
Yes. Just you. I want you to know this. You know, it's not just an ascent here, but to know that I am your God. I am here. I am here. So one thing that's fun about this next story, because I like it because it's just so it's so typical, is that the what is promised comes. This little layer of dew on the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine flaky substance, as fine as frost of the on the ground. And the Israelites saw it, and they said, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And I love that, because it's like when the manna comes, they don't even know what it is. When the sustenance is given, they can't recognize it. It comes in a totally unfamiliar, unexpected form. And I think that's another little wonderful piece to hold up, because how many times does that happen? How many times are we blind to the sustenance that God sends, and maybe even walk right by it because we don't have the eyes to see the manna that's being given? You're like, what is this stuff, you know? And I just think back about times where it's like, you know, nobody cares about me, nobody cares about my problem, nobody's here to support me, nobody, la la la, whatever it is I'm complaining about. And when we get into that complaining, murmuring, grumbling mode, it is a kind of a blindness, because all we see is what is not. And here is an example. Like, what is this? It's sort of that there's a blindness there. And the invitation is to, of course, have the eyes to be open to see where the sustenance is that God is sending. Where is the manna? Because the promise is that we will not starve in the desert. We will not be left alone in that time of chaos. But often the sustenance does not necessarily come in the exact form that we expect or are looking for. So I love this, that they didn't even know what it was. And it's Moses who had to say, this is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. And sometimes we need somebody else to say, well, remember, or see, or here I am. I'm the manna that God has given to you. And sometimes we don't even see that until, you know, post-event. Like, oh, I'm so glad that person called me in that moment. And to actually, you know, to take the step to say a prayer of thanks to God for, oh, thank you, God, for that little piece of sustenance that you sent me in that moment. To connect it with that. The next few verses are also really wonderful. Because what are the rules about the manna?
Just gather up as much as you need.
Gather only as much as you need.
For that day.
For that day. I think that is an amazing thing to ponder on. Because it's a built-in challenge to live in trust. And these guys react just exactly the way, you know, we typically would. We have something, well, let's, you know, make sure we're going to have enough to see us through. And because it's so hard to live daily, in a daily bread kind of way. Gather as much of it as you need. An omer, and this is what Moses thinks they need, an omer per person. And it says that they took what they needed. Some of them took more, some of them took less. And they each had as much as they needed. And if they were tempted to take more, what happens?
It doesn't save over.
It doesn't save. If you leave it till the next morning, if you take more than you need and keep it, if you try to hoard it, it gets wormy and foul and is no longer life-giving. It's no longer going to give sustenance. If you hoard it in, it ain't going to work. Because if we think about that, that will destroy or will completely act counter to the fact that the reason for giving it daily, he says, is to test them.
But the interesting thing is it saves over so that they have it on the Sabbath. If they gather twice as much on the sixth day, they have enough for the Sabbath. That's just so...
Yes. So that they have that time of rest.
So they still have the trust factor, but it works only the one day.
Yes. And that's... that whole thing about... can I relinquish my worry that, well, you know, well, God said that it would be okay the next day for the Sabbath.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure they woke up in the morning and said, did it really not go wormy? You know? Yes. Oh, it did. Okay. It's okay.
Yeah, we won't go hungry on the Sabbath.
And I just think about how we do those kinds of things in our mind. You know, it's, oh, yes, yes, I can trust, you know, but then these insidious little hooks come up and, you know, and I don't know, they're like a weed or something growing up in us that has to be pulled out that try to undermine and choke out that place of trust and that attitude of trust. So we're in good company, you know, with the Israelites doing this. I think it's good to step back and say, what is another level of teaching about this story? If we have these personal pieces about times in our life, times of wilderness where we are particularly challenged to trust that we'll make it through, that one morning we will see the horizon of the promised land of whatever newness we are seeking for in our lives. There's also, I think, dimensions in here that maybe we might say are more communal that are also very challenging. And also to us culturally as Americans, to say that the challenge is to not hoard, and that which we do hoard is no longer able to nourish and give life. And so it leads me to start these questions of where are we hoarding? Where is life being sapped away from what should be manna, but because of our relationship to it, it's not manna anymore. It's gone foul. When we say the prayer, our Father prayer, and we say, give us this day our daily bread, and we invoke that when we pray, what we're really saying is, I'm willing to enter into that kind of vulnerable place of trust where I can release my worry and my hanging on to the future and take what I need this day. And I think so many of us to really say, do I really want to live that way? It's a huge thing to pray that prayer. Because what we really want to say is, could you just make sure I have enough for retirement, or, you know, can you just give me enough so that, you know, this debt I have can be paid off, or, you know, I really want to go on this trip. Can I maybe have enough to go on? Or the good things like our children's college education or other things like that. That is what we are told as Americans from our culture. That's what we should be praying for. That's what we should be invoking, is security. And I, you know, I'm particularly challenged with this myself right now because of, and I'm sure actually a lot of people are in different ways, around finances and around planning for the future. And, you know, how much can I really tithe that 10%? Because if I do, I'm not going to be able to, you know, put in savings for my kids' college, or I'm not going to be able to, you know, pay my life insurance, or I'm not going to be all our insurance that we buy. I mean, I look at my budget, I'm like, good grief, what the percentage of insurance is ridiculous. Well, if you don't have it though, and you have to go to the hospital, you know, your whole life's shot because of the expenses. It's a real struggle. I mean, in very concrete ways, to say, what does it mean to live dependent on daily bread? And so I thought we might talk for a few minutes about, and just to hear some perspectives about, what is the difference between hoarding our resources of all kinds, and you know, responsible planning. What makes it the difference? What makes it turn into hoarding instead of, you know, what we're told is being responsible, financial responsibility, and using our resources, you know, responsibly and wisely? What do you think? What is the key that pushes us over into going against this kind of sense of depending each day that we will receive what we need?
Mm-hmm. One thing that comes to mind, hoarding seems to be based strongly on fear.
Yes.
Responsible planning, sort of. Getting health insurance or life insurance, that's sort of based on fear, but not as much as hoarding is based on fear.
Yeah. I thought about that too, is kind of what's the motivating energy behind it? And fear is a big one.
So we would have fear at one end of the continuum and appropriate stewardship at the other, perhaps?
Mm. Because if we have resources, we have to make choices about how to use them. What else? Any other thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, something that occurs to me, if we don't plan for the future and hoard, if you want to use that word, if we don't plan for the future, for health or for our old age or whatever, then the burden of that falls on somebody else. Either family or the government or the community or the county or whatever. Yeah. So is that right to let
that happened.
Yeah.
I think it is a little dilemma because I think, you know, God does want us not to be hung up on financial security, but
I mean, we're not going to come to any answers, you realize. These are all just things for us to consider.
Yeah, another thing that kind of crosses my mind is that one of the differences with hoarding is that it implies the inability to share. And so if we can retain the ability to share while we're still planning, maybe that's part of it.
That seems really, really key to me because there's this insistence in here about each person getting what they need. So if I'm encountered with somebody who has a need, you know, do I say, well, I can't spare because, you know, I have so much set aside and I'm going to need that? Or in that moment, can I release my fear and share and meet that person's need? Yeah, I think that's really critical.
I think that in our culture, that most of the time, most people are thinking of what they need today. They're not thinking so much about the future, but they're so bombarded by the media and what it says that we need, whether it's, you know, fancy cars or, you know, an elaborate place to live, that I think we lose the ability to look at hoarding or responsible planning because so many people are not in going toward responsible planning. They may not be hoarding, they may just be wasting, you know, which I think is a different issue.
But it's
maybe not here, but I think it becomes a factor.
Yes.
In how you look at what your needs really are. I think that's a hard thing for many people.
Something
really
a need or is it a want?
Yes. Well, I think that's an important side shoot of this is, are we receiving the manna and then not, and then wasting it, as you said, or spending it on things that are not of needs but are maybe way out of proportion to, it's not a simple want, but an actured want, like you said, by the, you know, propped up by the media. And you're right that I think in our culture, it's there's these complicated pieces of it, nuances, because we have so much, we are bombarded by so many messages, and yet so many people actually struggle day to day too, in terms of finances and you know, not quite having enough to meet the kind of lifestyle we've set up and all the various bills and all the insurances that they say you have to have and all of that. It's a real tension, I think, in our culture. Which why it seems to me that this cultivation in each of us of a sense of living in a daily stance of trust is so key, because I think that, to me, that's what allows us to set aside the fear or set aside the worry or say no to who's ever telling me, well, you can't do that. Or, you know, I had this wonderful conversation today with one of the staff members here who, you know, against everything that they should have done, you know, they sold their house, they got rid of all their stuff, and they came up here, you know, to live here. And I'm sure they got a lot of flack from people, like, how can you do that, you know? because it, you know, it's a pretty countercultural thing to do, to come up to a place where you're not making any money, you know? and I know when I joined the Jesuit Volunteer Corps at a college, a lot of young people got that from their parents, which was kind of interesting to me that the hurt your career, you know, to go off and be with the Indians of Montana, kind of like, what does that have to do with anything? You know, you're supposed to be heading on to law school or heading on to, so there's a lot of of things that come in, messages that come into us that I think that break down that trusting place in us, both external and then of course all the internal ones that come that try to choke that out of us.
I struggle with the problem of having a family member that is living near poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
And yet a lot of it is because of their own choices.
Mm-hmm.
And the dilemma of, do I help support them? Do I give to them? Or, you know, and by doing so, I would enable them to continue making these poor choices.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, it's really hard to know how to balance caring for them and wanting to do for them, but at the same time realizing that if I do for them, then they will never be able to do for it. I find that a tremendous dilemma.
Yes, and it's probably even harder if it's a family member, because
yes.
Probably everybody here has struggled that with people on the streets. And
yeah, but
do you give or not
family
give?
Family member, and it's just really hard to know how much to do for them and how much to hold back.
Yes.
Anybody has an answer to that?
Yeah, I was going to say, does anybody have any wonderful wisdom from your own experience of something similar, of how to discern that challenge? You know, is this God's given me the manna and I'm supposed to share it?
Well, one of the things I was thinking about in terms of what's right in planning and this kind of stuff, and I guess for me it's a question of if you've got the relationship with God, then somehow you will know and it will feel right. And, you know, for me, having health insurance, that's just a given. I need to do that. God, you know, there's no small voice saying, no, you don't need to do that. There is a small voice saying, no, you don't need to, you know, spend your money doing this, that, and the other thing. I mean, I'm very careful about something, but that small inner voice,
mm-hmm.
That trust relationship that I think I have, seems to be the answer with me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in terms of how much am I going to pledge and, you know, to my church and,
yes.
you know, all those kinds of things. If it feels right to me, then that seems to be right. And so far it seems to be working.
Yes.
And I guess that's sort of the answer to her question. If it feels right, do it. If you think it's going to not help them in the long run, don't.
And maybe that is that discernment of what is the motivation that's happening. Is it a struggle with a should, because somebody else is going to look at me and say I'm not taking care of my kin? Is it fear? Is it worry? Is it, and it can be a very complicated and subtle discernment, I think, to keep listening for what am I being called to do here. And as I said, particularly I think if it's a kin, it's very difficult. So I pray that God continues to help you discern what your call to this taking care of another's needs is, because that's what we're being called to do.
You know, basically been trusting, feeling my way, you know, this seems okay, but
yes.
I can't go further.
Yes.
Yes, sometimes I feel selfish because of that, but...
I've been struggling with what the meaning of living in the present is,
mm-hmm.
and living real time. You know, so much of our life is dealing with issues of the past, fear because of things in the past, or worry because of things might happen in the future.
Yes,
but when I can try to do things right in the present, I mean, that's where God is, right in the present.
Yes.
And, I mean, we know about him from the past. We can think about what, you know, he might or what things might happen, but I mean, I don't know. I know I've been struggling with that. You know, what does it mean to live really in the present and accept, you know, right now? And I can really get rid of a lot of anxieties and worries and fears if I start just doing something right now, you know, dealing with the issue right at the moment, not trying to plan too much about how it's going to work out or fear about why it went this way and so I'm going to do it different next time. You know, just do it.
Yes. And you know, I think what you're naming is another one of those underlining pieces of wisdom from this image of the daily bread is exactly that, is we only have now. God is now. And I think that's part of this symbolism of I will just give you enough bread for today is exactly what you're describing, is how do we cultivate that not being controlled by the past or the future? Because we know in our minds that today is all we have, but to surrender ourselves to that and to truly live that is, I think, one of the greatest spiritual challenges. And it's what the mystics continually invite us to, is what do you see now? And even then the Buddhists, I think of Thich Nhat Hanh, thinking, whatever you're doing now, fully do it. And I think that's true of discernment questions also, is all I can do is say, what do I feel now that I'm being called to? And I may regret it later, but all I can do is decide the now.
I think that it's really interesting. God had hung out with people for a long time, but yet he doesn't automatically give them the food. I mean, he knew they were going to be hungry.
Mm-hmm.
He knew they were, you know, going to need bread, that they were going to need meat. But I think it's really interesting that he waits until they have to ask for it to be given to them.
Well, and it's life. We are hungry. We are thirsty. We are despairing. We are, you know, it's to me the stories in Scripture are they emerge from the experience of the people. So they mirror what really is, the struggles that really are. You know, it wouldn't be a real story if they just, you know, they just trip through the desert, you know, no problem, no hunger, no, they just have this little quick trip to the promised land. It wouldn't be life. It would be something that maybe out here that we, oh, that's nice that it worked that way for them. But how could that be living word for us? Because that's not what often happens in real life, is you have the struggles.
I think it says that we need to remember to ask every day for what we need.
Yes. And that, I don't know where I heard this phrase, but it might actually have been in a dream, but it was like, come to God as a beggar. And I remember I saw those beggar bowls in the store, where his idea is you present, you know, figuratively, you present yourself to God each day. And the beggars, you know, actually went and presented their bowl, but that, you know, fill my bowl for today, for what I need. And that the bowls up there say, keep one of those empty bowls as a reminder that, you know, you present your bowl empty and then the bread will come into it that you need for that day. And what you get that day is enough. Even if it's one of the darkest days of your life, when we can turn, maybe that's the difference between somebody who's driven to suicide and someone who can make it through that dark moment, is whether they can turn their despairing heart to God to receive what the ounce of hope they need to make it to the next day, or whether they can't.
You raised the question a little bit ago about how this applies in a communal fashion, because my understanding is that this was really written with the community in mind. This is the defining story for the people of Israel, their identity. And as we're rehearsing the 40 years in the wilderness in Railroad Creek Valley with Holden's history, I think that's another parallel. Wes Preeb had no idea what he was getting into when he wrote that letter to Howe Sound. And
along the way people have had glimmers, and yet this continues to be a surprising gift. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's going to happen in 40 years with mine reclamation and funding, but it's another opportunity to kind of go forward with good courage.
Yes.
And those images have been sort of continuously raised up, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I've felt it in our congregation this year as we faced some budget things and always trying to be practical and responsible with our finances and our stuff, but also trying to stretch ourselves a little bit and go forward.
Yes.
It's like the willingness to be a little bit foolish in the eyes of the world, like the voices that say, you can't do that. And they, you know, people who say, watch me. and that is, it's like whether you can keep that doorway of trust open amid all the practicalities and the real issues you have to weigh and the real things we have to be attentive to, but whether we can keep that basic stance of trust that allows the surprising gift of manna to come in, like this wonderful surprising gift in the campaign that they're starting here, and this wonderful beginning to sustain Holden. So I leave you with that image of continuing to have that beggar's bowl space in us. That presents itself to God as the Israelites did to receive the manna, and to think about not simply eating bread, which is our the fruit of our own labor, and have that bread be manna, which is gift, so that we continually make the shift from thinking, you know, we've earned what we have, or we deserve what we have. It's kind of come about because of our own hard work. It's never simply that, but it's always gift. There's always that gift dimension to it. And the more I think we can cultivate that in our lives and in each day, then perhaps the worries and the fears and the doubts can recede a bit and maybe gradually be released, so that the dominant stance that we have is one of trust and relying on God for the daily bread that we need. So it's a beautiful invitation, I think, in this story to each of us. So I leave you with that image. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.